You and crime.
The last of this week's series of informal conversations, Quincy Howe has as his guest Dr. Winfred Overholser, superintendent of St. Elizabeth's Hospital, operated under the Federal Security Agency in Washington, D.C., and formerly president of the American Psychiatric Association. For his transcribed conversation, here is Quincy Howe.
Dr. Overholser, as a psychiatrist, you know that many criminals really suffer from mental diseases of one kind or another. But criminals, of course, aren't the only people who need a psychiatrist's services. A lot of the rest of us do, whether we're sick or well. Now, how, if at all, do the mental illnesses from which criminals suffer differ from other forms of mental and nervous disorder, Dr. Overholser?
Substantially, not at all. Everyone has drives. Everyone has emotions. Emotions and drives are not good or bad. They may be steered into good or bad channels, that is, channels which are not accepted by the public. The same drives, which may result in perfectly normal behavior in one person, may be result in behavior which the next person will call criminal.
That is, a man, for instance, who is urged to keep his family living in comfortable circumstances will work hard at his job, and that's a fine thing to do. But the criminal, also wanting to keep his family in comfortable circumstances, who goes out and hits somebody over the head and robs them of their wallet, that's the difference.
That's it, precisely. I mean, criminals are human beings who have caricatures, perhaps, of these drives, excesses of these drives, lacking in inhibitions, perhaps, but essentially not much different from the rest of us.
And one of the great differences, though, would be that the criminal's idea of social behavior is somewhat different, Dr. Overholser, from what yours or mine as good Unitarians would be.
Oh, quite. Yes, indeed.
Well, now, how is he able to spot any criminal tendencies in a psychiatric patient? Can you see these antisocial or other tendencies that might lead to crime in someone who might come to you for guidance?
Oh, yes, you can't predict that these tendencies will materialize, of course. There are certain manifestations of hatred, of aggressiveness, of violence, which may, under favorable or rather unfavorable circumstances, result in criminal behavior.
What kind of things would you notice, for instance, in the man's or a patient's behavior that would indicate this criminal tendency, antisocial line of action?
Well, there's a considerable number of offenses which are due to what we refer to as paranoid tendencies. That is, conditions in which the individual is convinced that he is right, but that he's being very much picked upon by others. That the world, so to speak, is wrong. And sometimes, not, of course, in all cases, by any means, in fact, perhaps in only a small proportion of cases, he may take the law into his own hands, so to speak, in order to avenge himself for his fancied wrongs.
Well, I've heard it said recently in connection with this series and other times that there's supposed to be sort of a crime wave on now. And yet, as far as the actual number of arrests for crimes of ordinary robbery and burglary and stealing cars, those don't seem to be so bad. What I understand is on the increase are crimes of violence, crimes showing psychological, nervous, mental disorder. That's what the criminologists say. Does that check in with your experience as a psychiatrist? Is there an increase of mental disorder leading to crime?
Oh, no, I don't think there's any evidence that there's any substantial increase in mental disorder. And I must say that I've been just a bit skeptical as to how much these alleged crime waves existed in the minds of the headline writers of the papers.
Well, they naturally always play up, you know, just as in politics, you only hear about the disagreements at the United Nations, never about the agreements. And I suppose the same way with crime, isn't it?
I suppose that's true. It is said that after a war, there is a release of aggressions, which may result in some increases in offenses of one sort and another. But I have a feeling that some of this wave, so-called, at least, is due to the undue publicity, perhaps, and the facilities of communication that are presented to the public.
But isn't it also true, Dr. Overholser, that there is a certain increase in nervous disorders and mental troubles just due to the high tension under which we live. Modern life doesn't exactly set one up for a peaceful acceptance of things as they are.
Well, I read a book recently which was written about 1808, in which one Thomas Trotter lamented greatly the evil effects in causing a nervous temperament of such violent situations as the tight lacing of stays and excessive horseback riding. In other words, there have always been times that people are worried about the mental stability of the public. And I'm not sure that that the public is any nearer a complete mental breakdown today than it was, let us say, 100 years ago. Perhaps the peculiarities are better recognized and publicized.
Well, that's a very, very encouraging view, Dr. Overholt. So you don't go along, then, with those who'd say that there's a kind of an acceleration in social change and that there's a time lag and people just aren't able now to keep up with social change as they were 100 years ago. There's always been social change, but it's happening awful fast now. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, well, to some extent, of course, that is true, and no one would say that life is simple today. I'm sure of that. On the other hand, I don't think statistically there's very much evidence that mental disorder, by and large, is increasing. It's a fact that there are some types of it that are getting a great deal of attention, and a lot of people are consulting the psychiatrists who in the old days perhaps would have suffered in silence.
And all types of mental disorder are more widely recognized as
that is,
such. That would be
that
a good
is the point. That's one of the good things, if there is any good thing that ever comes out of a war, that came out of World War II, I think. A better understanding of the nature of mental disorder and the recognition of the fact that it's not something to be ashamed of.
Now, to what extent do our courts of justice, especially our judges who hand out the sentences to criminals, to what extent are these men and these institutions open to the latest findings of psychiatry?
Well, in moderation. The law moves, of course, in general, something of the majesty of a glacier. But it does move. And judges are coming, I think, to a somewhat more general recognition of the fact that it isn't just the name of the offense that tells you what you ought to do with the offender. They are recognizing that there are differences in offenders, and they, and indeed the laws passed by the legislatures, are making provision for a more elastic disposition.
I think I read or heard something you said to the effect that the judge is really the key man in this whole business of treating the criminal, because he's the fellow who hands out the sentence.
Oh, yes, if you're going to let him say where the sentence shall be served and just how long it shall be, there's no question about his being the key man. And I suppose that judges hate to let go of any of their prerogatives. But in some states, the amount of definiteness allowed to the judge is being cut down very materially, and the dispositions are being left more and more in the hands of a board which takes into consideration the psychological and the social factors that operate on the offender.
Well, now, how about the places that these people are sent to pay their debt to society, as some people like to phrase it, and as I understand, the psychiatrist doesn't care for that expression, but how about these, prison versus, for example, a mental hospital?
Well, of course, that depends on the mental state of the offender. Some offenders are, as the law puts it, insane. That is, they are frankly abnormal mentally to a very considerable degree, so much so that a jury, perhaps, has decided that they are so sick that they won't profit by correctional treatment, that they should not be dealt with, indeed, as criminals at all. There are others, of course, who are recognized or considered as, in general, pretty normal individuals, and they are sent to prison.
Now, would the judge have any possibility, any authority to overrule a jury and say to this fellow, look here, you shouldn't go to prison at all. You ought to go to a mental hospital, or perhaps vice versa?
Well, ordinarily, there's administrative latitude given there so that if a prisoner gets to prison and is found to be mentally ill, he may be transferred to a mental hospital. And if, conversely, he is sent to a mental hospital and is found not to be mentally ill or recovers while there, he may be sent back to the court for further consideration as to what disposition should be made.
Well, then, Dr. Overhaul, sir, on the sentencing of a man, he's sentenced to a certain number of years, certain stretch of time in prison. Is a similar sentence imposed to on people who are sent to mental hospitals, or is that left up to the hospital?
Oh, no, entirely. I mean, it's an interesting thing that the courts recognize that they are no good as prophets when it comes to saying how long a mental disorder is going to last. And yet, with the greatest blitheness, they will say that 2 years will cure this man because that's the term that's laid down in the law. We send him to prison for 2 years and he'll be all right. Of course, the chances are that either he might be all right before that or he might be unfit ever to be released.
Now, what do you say, Dr. Overhaul, sir, when people come to you, as I'm sure they do, and say, well, you as a psychiatrist are just trying to coddle these criminals. They ought to be taken and just made to pay through the nose for these terrible things they've done. What do you say to people when they bring up that kind of objection?
Well, I say that they're giving themselves an emotional release by talking that way. They're putting themselves in the same situation as the group that takes part in the lynching in the South, only they're doing it in a somewhat more polite way. They're giving vent, in other words, to their feelings of revenge. Actually, a good many offenders, if they were left to the consideration of the psychiatrist, would not be released at all, whereas if they were sentenced as offenders, they might be out in a relatively short time.
So the psychiatrist is quite frequently a good deal tougher than the judge would be.
I think he's protecting society very often a good deal more effectively than the fixed sentence procedure would.
Then what do you think, Dr. Overholzer, of the old idea that poverty is the main breeder of crime? Is that the main factor as you see it as a psychiatrist?
Well, no, I don't think there's any main factor. I think we ought to bear in mind that every bit of behavior of everybody, whether we call him normal or feeble-minded or whatever we may call him, is the result of a lot of things. It's the result of the interplay between the environment on the one hand, the immediate situation, and the psychological makeup of the individual on the other, which in turn is determined by everything that's gone before.
I see. Well, now, finally, Dr. Overholzer, I wonder if you could sum up in about a minute what you particularly yourself would like most to get across to the public about psychiatry and crime.
In relation to crime, I think the important thing is to bear in mind that the significant thing, item one, of course, if we may cure the offender, fine. If we can make sure that he will not prey upon society, that's fine. In the second place, if there is no assurance, no reasonable assurance that he's going to conduct himself properly when he goes out, there ought to be provision for seeing that he doesn't have a chance to prey on society. There's been too much interest in revenge and too little upon the real prevention of further offenses against society.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Overholzer, for bringing this series of ours to such a splendid close. Thanks for being with us.
You have been listening to You and Crime, Columbia's subject of the week in its regular series devoted to topics of popular interest. Joining Quincy Howe today in this transcribed conversation was Dr. Winfred Overholzer, superintendent of St. Elizabeth's Hospital, operated under the Federal Security Agency in Washington, D.C. Listen in again on Monday when the subject of the week will be You and Christmas.
Here's a lineup that provides just about everything in listening pleasure. Joan Davis is a Dizzy department store sales girl. Laughter and Tears with the Goldbergs, Lucille Ball delighting you with her comedy program, My Favorite Husband. Yes, there are three reasons for making Friday night another Stay Tuned Night with CBS. And another, that thrilling new adventure show, Pursuit. And still another, the charming comedy of campus life, Young Love. The Goldbergs, Lucille Ball, Joan Davis, Young Love, and Pursuit. That wonderfully varied lineup is yours every Friday night on most of these same CBS stations. This is CBS, where the Goldbergs are every Friday night, the Columbia Broadcasting System.